Sadly, Renee couldn't be with us this month. He's jet-setting across the world at the moment. This month, we are joined for Ask an Astronomer by Benjamin Shaw.
Hello.
So, let's crack on with the first question. Owen on Twitter asks, how can we tell the difference between different types of redshift for distant active galactic centres?
So, the first thing to probably explain with this one is where the idea of redshift and the Doppler shift actually comes from. So, if we have a gas and we heat it up in the lab, we'll see that the gas starts to emit light. But if we use a spectrometer, something that only allows you to see light of a particular wavelength, hydrogen gas, for example, will only emit a specific set of wavelengths. It won't emit across the whole band. And so you'll see an emission line at exactly 656.3 nanometers, which is the hydrogen alpha line, which is a common line used to observe the sun, for example, safely through eclipse glasses or whatever. And it'll emit light at a few other specific wavelengths as well. However, that hydrogen alpha line being at that particular wavelength is predicated on the fact that both you and the gas are in a stationary frame with respect to each other. So that means that the gas and you are static, neither of you are moving with respect to each other. If the hydrogen were moving away from me sat in the lab with my spectroscope, I'd see the hydrogen alpha line not at 656.3 nanometers, but I'd see it at a longer wavelength. And the shift in wavelength is determined by the rate at which the source is moving away. Conversely, if the source were moving towards me, you'd see H alpha at a shorter wavelength. And this is known as the Doppler effect, and the same effect you observe when an ambulance or a police car goes past you with its siren on, and you hear the drop in pitch as it moves away. And this is because depending how you're moving with respect to a source, the rate at which you receive successive wavefronts changes. So imagine we're in a tennis court, for example, and I'm throwing tennis balls at you. We're both stood still, and if I throw one ball per second at you, at a speed of 1 meter per second per ball, you'll receive a ball every second. But if I start walking backwards away from you at, say, half a meter per second, you'll receive a tennis ball now every 2 seconds. So the rate at which you receive the balls decreases. And correspondingly, if I were a light source, the rate at which you would see successive wavefronts also decreases. So you would measure the light source as redshifted, even though the rate at which I'm throwing the tennis balls, or the wavefronts, hasn't changed from my perspective. Now in astronomy, there are a few different phenomena that can cause redshift. For example, simpler Doppler shifting can be caused by a source moving towards or away from an observer, such as a star. And we see this effect in binary systems, for example, where a star is moving towards us for one half of its orbit and away for the other. This effect is how we find many exoplanets. As a planet moves around a star, it causes the star to wobble to and fro, and we can measure this wobble as the star oscillates through being blue and redshifted in time with the orbital period of the planet. Similarly, nearby galaxies might be moving towards or away from us. The Andromeda galaxy, for example, is heading towards the Milky Way, and so the hydrogen gas, or any other gas in that galaxy, is blue-shifted as a consequence of that. Now, we can extend this idea to include the expanding universe. As the universe expands, objects that are further away from us appear to be moving away faster. This isn't because they're moving across space relative to us, rather that they're being carried away by the expanding space itself. So going back to the tennis ball analogy, this is like you standing at one end of a conveyor belt, me standing on the conveyor belt, someone switches it on and now I'm being carried away from you, and like before, as the distance between us is increasing, this time not because I'm moving across space relative to you, but because I'm being carried away by space itself. As a consequence, you receive tennis balls at a lower rate than I'm throwing them. And this is called cosmological redshift, and it's an observational phenomenon we see in very distant galaxies, and it's useful for calculating the rate of the expansion of the universe. For example, if we measure the brightness of something we know very well, such as an accretion-powered supernova, by knowing its brightness and measuring its redshift, we can get a value for the speed of the expansion of the universe. Now, there's one more type of redshift that occurs due to the curvature of space due to the presence of masses. In general relativity, masses cause space to curve. So take a mattress, and if I roll a ball bearing, say, across the mattress, it will move across the mattress in a nice flat 2D plane, forwards and backwards, left and right. Now, if I take a great big bowling ball and put it in the centre of the mattress, the bowling ball causes the mattress to be depressed into a third dimension, up and down. And now if I try and roll the ball bearing across the mattress, it will follow a curved trajectory in 3 dimensions. Now, say I wanted to roll a ball bearing away from the bowling ball, so it starts in the centre of the mattress near the bowling ball, and I want to roll it towards the edge. It would lose energy trying to climb out of the well that the bowling ball has created. And so if you were catching a ball bearing at the edge of the mattress, you would measure its speed at the point you capture it as less than it began its journey at, because it's lost energy climbing out of this well. Now, this analogy breaks down due to a consequence of special relativity, which is that light always travels relative to space at the same speed in a vacuum. And so if a massive object emits light, that light will not slow down as it leaves the gravitational well of the object. However, energy is still lost, and its loss manifests as an increase in the wavelength, and we call this increase a gravitational redshift. And this is only usually measurable near very massive objects. For example, if there's hydrogen gas near a neutron star, in an accretion disk or a pulsar wind nebula or whatever, then the H-alpha line that we talked about before would be shifted into the red due to the gravitational field of the neutron star. Now, the questioner asks how we tell the difference between these phenomena, and the answer to this largely depends on the nature of the object you're looking at. Gravitational redshift is, in general, a really small effect, and we only usually need to consider its effect near massive objects like black holes or neutron stars or white dwarfs. To get an idea of the gravitational redshift effect, we need to consider something called the Schwarzschild radius of a massive object. So this is the radius an object would have to be at a given mass in order for the escape velocity to be equal to the speed of light. So for the Earth to have an escape velocity equal to the speed of light, it'd have to have a radius of about 8 millimetres. So the Earth is much bigger than its Schwarzschild radius. For a person whose mass is, say, 100 kilograms, to have an escape velocity equal to the speed of light, your mass would have to be compressed into a sphere with a radius of about 1/10 of a yoctometer. So that's 10 to the minus 25 metres. To understand the contribution to the redshift of a system by gravitational effects, we need to consider how many times bigger an object is with respect to its Schwarzschild radius. So a nebula, for example, is trillions of times larger than its Schwarzschild radius, and so the effect of gravitational redshift on light moving away from a nebula would be about one part in a trillion. But a neutron star, which is a sphere about the mass of the Sun, but about 20 kilometres across, its Schwarzschild radius is about 2 kilometres. So it's only 5 or 10 times larger than its Schwarzschild radius, and so the contribution is much higher, as high as 1 part in 10. So if you're looking at a redshifted nebula or a redshifted galaxy, you can be fairly sure that the redshift you're seeing is not gravitational. So coming on to cosmological redshift, how do we tell whether something is being carried away by the space expanding, or whether it's just moving relative to us and space? For example, the motion of galaxies in a cluster. Well, at very large distances, say hundreds of megaparsecs, the redshift is predominantly cosmological. For more nearby galaxies, such as those in the local group nearby us, the group of galaxies we're in, normal everyday Doppler shift dominates the redshift. The difficulty comes when a galaxy is at a distance where the cosmological and the Doppler redshift contribute roughly the same amount, and you have to carefully disentangle the contributions from each effect. In this case, you'd need an accurate measure of the distance to the galaxy, such as a thermonuclear supernova, a pulsating variable star, and perhaps one we've better calibrated them, gamma ray bursts as well. So if you can measure the distance independently, then you have an accurate model for the expansion of the universe, and you include contributions from things like the Earth's orbit around the Sun and the Sun's orbit around the Milky Way, and then in principle you can measure where your redshift is coming from.
That was great. So disentangling different redshifts is something I've never really thought about before. And for our second and final question this month, Jacqueline on Twitter asks, given Pluto was demoted on the basis of it having other stuff in its orbit, shouldn't we demote Neptune on the same basis, given Pluto crosses its orbit?
Well, that'd probably be a controversial thing to do, I think, but to answer this question, we should probably go back to why Pluto was demoted in the first place. So, back in the early 2000s, a bunch of other stuff was found near Pluto. We suddenly became sensitive enough to see very small objects towards the edge of the solar system. And the first of these was Eris, an object called 2003 UB313, and it has a moon called Dysnomia, and it threw a real spanner in the works because it's actually bigger than Pluto. And it's very nearby Pluto. All these things are clustered in a thing around the edge of the solar system called the Kuiper Belt. So a little bit like the asteroid, but more icy and with a much bigger radius. And a lot of other objects began to get thrown up as well. All these little planetoids, whatever we wanted to call them at the time. Lots of things sort of orbiting together at these great distances in the outer solar system. Now, this caused a problem primarily because these things weren't really disentanglable from Pluto, at least the larger ones. And so we were faced with the possibility of having a lot of stuff in the outer solar system, new planets in the outer solar system. And we needed really something to call them, because if we just said Eris is a planet, Quawar is a planet, all these other things are planets, Sedna is a planet, then we're potentially going to have a solar system with tens, potentially hundreds of planets in the solar system, which is going to be a nightmare for textbooks in schools. It's going to be a nightmare, really, when we're trying to, you know, gather statistics of exoplanetary systems. You know, what we call planets really matters in those cases. And so a set of criteria were devised by the International Astronomical Union in the mid-2000s that effectively go out of their way to exclude Pluto from being called a planet. We knew we wanted to keep the first eight as planets, and we knew we wanted to exclude these other smaller objects that seem to be clustered together. And so the IAU came up with a bunch of things that keep Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus and Neptune as planets, but exclude everything else. And those three criteria were, it has to be in an independent orbit around the Sun, immediately excludes things like moons and asteroids that are caught around planets. There is a caveat to that, but we'll come to that. The second criterion was that it has to be massive enough to have pulled itself into a sphere. So the bigger, the more massive an object is, the more self-gravity it has, and so the easier it is for it to pull itself into a sphere. Its lowest sort of surface potential, and it's an effect we called hydrostatic equilibrium. Pluto passes on these two. It fails on the third one. The third one, it needs to have swept its orbit clear of other material. Pluto shares its orbit with a lot of other stuff. A weird and diverse collection of moons, but it also shares its orbit with a lot of other Kuiper Belt objects as well. It's not isolated in space the way the other planets are. And so Pluto failed on that condition. Although Pluto then got demoted to the status of dwarf planet, which was a bit of a controversial thing, and there are still movements out there that try and get Pluto reclassified as a planet, and I think that's fair enough. What it also did was it made us look a little bit closer at the asteroid belt and take things like Ceres, which is the largest of the asteroids. It's in an independent orbit around the Sun. It's massive enough to have pulled itself into a sphere, but it still shares its orbit with the rest of the asteroids in the asteroid belt. And so that elevated Ceres into the status of dwarf planet from just a large asteroid. And so there was something to gain from this, so the pro-Pluto people can rest easy a little bit knowing that a previous asteroid has now got dwarf planet status. The questioner asked specifically about Neptune. Now, the problem with Neptune is that there is a point in Pluto's orbit at which it's closer to the Sun than Neptune is. And this is because the orbits aren't sitting in a nice sort of ever-increasing circles. Pluto's orbit is slightly squashed. It's inclined by about 17 degrees to the ecliptic, the flat plane of the solar system. And so there is a point in its orbit where it becomes closer to the Sun than Neptune. However, Neptune's orbit is its own orbit. Nothing lives in Neptune's orbit. Plenty of stuff lives in Pluto's orbit, and that's where the distinction is. And that's, you know, it's the same with every other planet. Every other planet has its orbit to itself. Now, if we were to demote Neptune on these conditions, we'd have to probably demote things like the Earth as well, because the Earth, from time to time, crosses the orbits of comets, for example, and that's how we see meteor showers. A comet comes into the inner solar system, leaves a trail of stuff, the Earth crashes into it, and we see a meteor shower. If we were to do that, we would have to say that the Earth has not swept its orbit clear of other material. But it has, because Earth pretty much has its orbit to itself. And so on that basis, I don't think we can declassify Neptune, because there may well have been other stuff living in Neptune's orbit when it formed, but it rapidly cleared it out. Pluto didn't do that. It's not massive enough to have kicked other stuff out of its orbit, and so Pluto shares its orbit, Neptune doesn't. The fact that they cross each other doesn't really matter. There is a caveat to this, which we don't really consider. Planets that are orbiting around anything, or moons that are orbiting around anything, have these things called Lagrangian points. The Earth has five of these. They're areas in space where if you were to place an object, it would stay there in lockstep with the planet. So, for example, there's a Lagrangian point called L1 between us and the Sun, and if you were to place a spacecraft there, it would orbit around the Sun in lockstep with the Earth. And there's another one called L2 on a line from the Sun, Earth, L2. But there are also these other ones that trail and lead the planet as well around the Sun, and they're very, very stable. And in massive planets like Jupiter, they tend to capture stuff. There's a lot of things called Trojan asteroids living in Jupiter's L4 and 5 Lagrangian points, and they go round and round with Jupiter. So in that respect, Jupiter hasn't cleared its orbit of that material. But it's not intercepting that material. Generally, that material does live there. Jupiter has no mechanism by which to eject it, because these Lagrangian points are very stable. So when astronomers say a planet has to have swept its orbit clear to be considered a planet, it explicitly ignores the presence of Trojan asteroids. So to sum up, the questioner, no, we shouldn't demote Neptune. Neptune has its orbit to itself. Pluto does not.
Another great answer. Thanks, Ben.
Okay.